Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome back to The Ruck. Jonesy, for decibels, atmosphere, intensity, where does Cardiff on Saturday rank?
Right up there. I can't remember there being a noisier or more atmospheric or passionate atmosphere in the stadium for maybe 10 years, maybe more. And I think that's what happens when the visiting coach says he doesn't think it's an iconic stadium and he's not worried about the noise, because every Welsh person who reads that thinks, when I get there, I'm going to open my lungs and scream at people.
Yes.
I think, look, these people have played in front of big crowds before, but I think just now and again, maybe once every 3 or 4 years, the intensity of the stadium, especially one that's all enveloping, does make a difference to the result. And I don't think England handled it.
Those are the dulcet tones of Stephen Jones. I'm Owen Slott. We have England captain Sarah Hunter joining us later in the pod. But for the whole of the show, we are also graced by the presence of Ben Ryan, who I think is probably fair to say has had more babies named after him in Fiji than anyone in the history of the game. Ben, can we go with that today?
Maybe.
Ben, if you haven't been...
None of them were his, though, so you've got to point that out.
Well, thank you. We should cover that off, shouldn't we?
Yeah, that...
So if you haven't been on this planet, then you wouldn't know that Ben coached Fiji to the Olympic Sevens gold 2016. The book Sevens Heaven, The Beautiful Chaos of Fiji's Olympic Dream, is on the way to being a film.
Yep.
Have they got anyone to play you yet?
No, they haven't yet, but no, it is.
You get asked that all the time, don't you?
I do, yeah. I do. I don't mind, but I'm quite looking forward to actually seeing the film eventually. But no, it's all progressing really well. Really happy with that.
You should have won the book at the Sports Book of the Year. I thought that was the most amazing book.
Thank you. Should have won it.
Another cataclysmic Six Nations weekend. I know it's a cliche, but Six Nations always delivers. What does form count for in the Six Nations? Ireland were the form team coming in and have had none of it since it started. England had form for two games and then lost it on Saturday. Wales were average for two games and are now a brace off a Grand Slam. How do we make sense of this all? Ben, you watch the weekend.
No, I mean, I think, well, one thing at the moment is that we've got, you know, particularly with Ireland, Wales and England, we have three teams that are, you know, are near the top of the world ranking. So there's already fierce competition before you go into Six Nations. And I do think the atmosphere has a part to play, and it did at the weekend. You know, as Stephen talked about, you know, that... I wasn't there, but by all accounts an incredible atmosphere, and that is going to change how players react and how teams react, not only just in the game, but you know, that, as we talked about, just that ridiculously long build up to the match. So there was all of that happening, and it's finally balanced at the moment, I think. And form does, you know, the Ireland are playing well, but they just seem to have lost a little bit of the pace of the ball that they're getting at the moment. If you even watch the game in Italy, you know, and Connor's Murray's just not at the level he was, neither's Sexton. You could see when Sexton came off at the weekend just how upset he was, probably with his own personal performance as well. And if your halfbacks aren't really firing, then you know that's going to slow down what you're trying to achieve, particularly in the Ireland setup where a lot of it is phase orientated and requires those two to be right on their money.
Steve, do you think that Ireland are in any way similar to where England were in the autumn of 2017, when they're still winning, but they were sort of rumbling along, not very impressively or conclusively, and then obviously England really hit the buffers in the following Six Nations?
It's hard to say. It could be, but the thing is that, what we said before about form, when New Zealand were the form team when they came to Ireland, and they got absolutely duffed, really, really well beaten. So Ireland became the form team, and quite rightly so. Then they were really well beaten by England, and the same thing with Wales and England. So it's very difficult to chart here the progress of a team. I don't know, really. Ben is quite right. I mean, Ireland were playing by their standards a jog on Sunday. But I don't know whether it's yet to be proven whether we should panic about Ireland or England, and as to whether they've lost what they had. Because only 2 weeks ago and 3 weeks ago, England put in two excellent performances. So it's part of the fascination of sport. It must drive the coaches nuts, but absolutely nuts. But as far as the surprise element of sport goes, it is absolutely wonderful.
It sort of shows, as you said, Ben, you know, you've got three teams that are near the top of the world. You can't chart what's going to happen. I mean, and we in the media are endlessly trying to analyse why so-and-so's done well or badly and what's going to happen next. You know, we've seen enough, therefore we can predict what's going to happen next. And this Six Nations just doesn't work like that.
It doesn't. I mean, I do think there's something around preparation times for key games. So, I don't mean about keeping players fresh. I mean the tactical approach. So if you took the England-Ireland game, the Ireland-England game, England had a long preparation. They had a plan A that they executed beautifully to time, took Ireland a little bit by surprise, and they dominated. And I think on the back of that, they kept that game plan, was helped a lot by France not picking a back three. They're actually playing the back three. And they kept that momentum up. And then the third week against Wales knew exactly what was going to come as a plan A. They were still going to go to the air. Wales had a very good back three. Their nine also harried Farrell really well at 10. Slowed down the space that both Ben Youngs had for his box kicking and Farrell had for his other open kicking game. And that meant their kicks weren't on the money and weren't as accurate as they possibly could be. Now, go 3 weeks earlier or however long ago the Ireland game was, they weren't quite aware perhaps of that. His tactics didn't put those halfbacks under the pressure that Wales did, and the back three didn't deal with it as well. They weren't perhaps expecting it, so all of those things I think contribute to it. And as a coach, you know, I think Eddie prepared very well for that game against Ireland, had a game plan, and it worked. We don't know if they had a plan B against Ireland, because he didn't need to use it. He did against Wales. He needed a plan B. They didn't fall into that. And I think that's how sometimes you get those form changes, and Ireland have done that before as well, where the big game coming and everything goes towards that. Wales, I think, also got that right. They had that second game against Italy that they made, 10 changes, and they really had the bigger picture. They were thinking of that England game. They had seen how England played. They were aware tactically to respond to that, and then also bring their own game. And I think, you know, Wales looked at both sides of the ball when they analysed, and both teams when they analysed it a bit more thoroughly than England did, and that showed at the weekend.
But Steve, Barnsley's hammered England this morning for their inability to react and adapt, and that's been a bit of a theme for England for far too long. Ironically, Owen Farrell was talking last week in the endless build-up about how England would adapt and how they, you know, that he was aware that this is something that should be happening, but the business of the challenge of being able to think on your feet and play to what you see is a big part of the game. As you say, Ben, that when England played those tactics against Ireland and slightly caught them off, Ireland didn't really adapt very well. I mean, are we expecting? I don't think we are. I said it in my piece today. England should have adapted, but is it that hard to react and go, well, listen, that's not working. Let's stop kicking to Liam Williams, who seems to catch everything.
An international match, it would be lovely for coaches if they talk about pathways to get the team together. Then, win or lose, they say, well, we're making progress. Then they say we got these learnings, and then they say, right, we got plan A. Now we've got to switch to plan B. If it all worked like that, it would be easy to be a coach. But it doesn't work like that. I mean, again, I don't know whether. There came a time when England had to switch and they didn't. They had to switch things and they didn't. I don't know why they didn't do that. Whether there was just something in the whole game that is almost intangible that we can't report on because we don't know what it was. Whether there was something in the whole game that was just against them, or whether Farrell, who and blimey, I watched the game again this morning. Gareth Davis was really, really good in defence. I would always play the guy. I was amazed they didn't play him a big at the start. But you're quite right, Ben. Gareth Davis was superb in harrying. He's like the fastest open side flanker. But I'm not going to say England, you know, you didn't adapt, and you because the tactics are not always obvious where you should go anyway. Mm. Wales might move on somewhere during the game. So and in fact, they did. You know, Wales brought on a much fresher bunch of carriers and who carried better than the starting team. So it's just difficult. I'm not going to say to Eddie or Farrell, blimey, lads, you completely blew that because you didn't change the game. It's not that easy to do. Mm. It's not that easy to do, I don't think.
So we agree that the noise and the atmosphere in the Principality Stadium played a key role in the way that unfolded. England won't. Is that a problem or a factor going forward? Because England aren't going to play an away game like it between now and the end of the World Cup, are they? I mean, England were in a World Cup final. I would put money on there being more white shirts in there than anyone else. The thing about that, the Cardiff Stadium is a complete one-off.
But the thing is, I'd make it wider than that. I look, you're going to disagree with me here because you have to get, Owen, you have to get a story every day. I'm just tired of the sniping, not just at the country's rugby team or their coach, and this goes for everybody, but actually making aspersions about the nation. Now, whether or not you're playing in a huge stadium, a noisy stadium, I think that's beneath people. And I think that winds players up and it winds everybody up. So it's not just going into a stadium. I think people should just shut up and get on with it. And what they call mind games, they're not mind games, they're mindless games.
Yeah, I hate that mind game stuff. I just don't know why.
Do you?
My God, it just drives me mad. It's like, why are you wasting your time doing all of this? Get on with, preparing teams, resting when you need, having clear thinking and not doing all of this. I just don't get that. I just don't get it.
Do you think in any way then that Warren Gatland singling out Carl Sinclair in advance, making him feel, making him know that they were watching and that making him, putting the pressure on him early, do you think that had nothing to do with the fact that it played out as he had foreseen?
I'm not quite, I mean, you guys will know more than me. I don't know if it was he was reacting to a question that was asked to him about Carl Sinclair. I'm not sure if that was the case and that he didn't actually kind of bring it up himself independently.
That's a good point. I don't know the answer to that either.
I think he was asked a question, but...
But still, to drop out the words emotional time bomb, that's... Yeah.
Yeah, I like Carl. I think he's a great player, but the occasion was, at times, he got over aroused. That may or may not be linked into what Warren said. I don't know, and you never know. And maybe you should ask Carl that. And he's going to have a long and illustrious career, I hope, because he's a terrific player. And I don't think Warren particularly played any mind games. I think that was I don't know where that came from, and I think he would say. I think that he was asked the question about Carl. So. It was Eddie really that was talking about a little bit more mind games. I just don't get it. I don't understand it. And like, I'm much prefer to be a bit more like Schmidt, where he just keeps quiet and gets on with things. And
but where Eddie called out Reece Patchell famously a year ago. Did that not help? I mean, did that not help them win a game?
No, I don't particularly think so. It'd be interesting if you asked the questions to Eddie, whether he actually thinks it's part of his weapons as an international head coach to utilise that to try to get under the skin of the opposition the week before games.
I've asked him that question, and he says yes. I'll do anything to help us win a game. And the one time that he's reined back afterwards or acknowledged that he got it wrong since he's been with England was when he had a go at Johnny Sexton and said that. His parents should be worried for him playing in the game, and sometime after that, he said, "I overstepped a line there."
Well, I agree with Ben, but the thing is, if you're going to do that, if you think that's what part of your job is, fine. But then don't complain when your tight head prop has 5 minutes where he gives away two penalties because you've helped to create the atmosphere of confrontation.
You're absolutely completely
the two
right
teams.
There. Yeah,
but also having said that, I think Sinclair is the best news for English rugby the whole season. And they've so wanted a guy. I mean, the people they've had recently have been either not dominant enough in the scrum or made no efforts around the field, or gave, in Dan Cole's case, gave away too many penalties, which Sinclair doesn't usually do. And I think you're talking here a titan, a 50-cap titan, who could also play for the Lions as well. I just think I absolutely love the guy.
Yeah, well, I'm with you on that.
I feel the same. I thought it was interesting to talk about how Eddie handles media and that. After the game, he did something pretty unusual for any coach, and he basically said to the media, can you guys please just go soft on him, not soft on him, go light on him. He's a young man, and he could do without this. He will be a great player. He is a great player. And for a coach to ask that question like that is...
Yeah, but then you go 12 months earlier and Rhys Patchell. It's like he set him up to...
The degree of hypocrisy...
Are you sure you're nominated for this award tonight?
Easy. It all happens later, Jonesy.
I just think there's too many... I don't know how the best way of explaining this, really, but say one thing, do another, and it just changes week by week. And I was watching the post-match press conference when it was Eddie and Owen Farrell, and when there were times when Owen was talking that Eddie was actually looking at his phone, and it's like, well, you know, that for me is showing like a bit of a lack of respect for your players, or just that your focus is elsewhere. England have been playing brilliantly, and I think they've got their selection so much better than it has been, and people like Carl have breathed the fresh air. I thought Tom Curry was sensational. Mm. You know, they really have, you know, got the makings of a team that can go to the World Cup and win the World Cup. But I just think there's other stuff that's just needless.
Ben, on the subject, on when it's international rugby, a team loses a game or has a great victory, and as Jonesy says, we're all trying to chart where they are, you know, especially with in a World Cup here, you know, are they up here, are they down there, or whatever. If it's a Premiership game, or maybe from your background in Sevens, where there's lots of games, if you lose one, then you take it on the chin and you go up there and you move on, and you haven't got all this judgment, oh, we're no good anymore. Is that just the nature of international rugby, that because it has more media attention and it's slightly rarer, that we seem to consider it like that? Or do you think that if England do lose a big game like that, where they don't adapt and they're slightly quelled by the atmosphere and the noise or something, they aren't actually the team we thought they were?
I think you're right in the first place, and it was already mentioned earlier, you know, journalists do need to come up with stories every day, and so that will be an angle that people will be looking at on Monday. Are England, you know, the real deal? Have they a real test has come and they failed? Actually, there was a real test in Ireland a few weeks ago and they passed that with flying colours.
Yeah.
So you can't suddenly like turn around and say they tactically Wales countered their tactics, and then there wasn't the bandwidth to then have a second way of playing, and then Wales brought a fairly simple attritional game to them, particularly in the second half, where the fresh ball carriers made some big incisions off one out passing, but it did give them a foothold in the game and some possession, and the momentum swung Wales's way. England have now, they look happier on the field than they did 12 months ago. Their selection is more consistent, and they've got the right people in the right places. I'd still be playing Elliot Daly at 13, but that's just me, and Henry Slade's doing a great job. But I do think England are playing very well.
And so, Jonesy, likewise, Wales, when we're charting them, are they the real deal all of a sudden, or was that likewise the game in unique circumstances of that stadium where they offered the match of their lives?
Well, I think they're not the real deal. If you mean, you know, are they contenders for the World Cup to win the World Cup yet? But I do think they're still just slightly underpowered. Thomas Francis has come on really well. He's not a natural sort of carrier like Sinclair is, but he's come on really well. But I still think they're underpowered, and I went down like a lead balloon before the game by suggesting that they had two open side flankers and they're better off only having one. But I do think the pack will gain when Taulepe Faletau comes back, and I think they ought to put Moriarty on the blind side because I think he's happier there. I'd just play one of Tipperick and Navidi. I know it's sacrilegious because everybody loves them, and Navidi's been man of the match twice in three games, but I think these days you've got to have massive carriers for better or worse, and I think they're still slightly underpowered. Interesting as to what they do with Dan Biggar, because I think he should have started, but the way Warren handled it with Anscombe playing by no means spectacularly, but all right. And then it was like the entrance of the gladiators, like, you know, yeah. 62 minutes only came to, you know, make his dispositions and win the game. So possibly they might do that again. Interesting. But I think Wales are 2-3 short. And also, I didn't like the way that Manu Tuilagi, who didn't show an awful lot of appetite for the game, sort of almost walked past Hadley Parks in an embarrassing fashion. And, you know, it's amazing to say it, but in that game, and all Wales are trying to develop, in that sort of game, they would have been just as well playing Jamie Roberts there, because they weren't really trying to beat England by going out wide. So it was interesting. I don't think I think Scott Williams had come really back into contention alongside Jonathan Davis.
Ben, have you got a view on Bigger V. Anscombe, which sounds like it'll carry on right until the...
No, I don't. I think one of the coaches mentioned it, maybe Eddie, that, you know, there are, you know, they've got two very good out halves, and they've got some good options at nine. It'll be down to form, injury, horses for courses sometimes in strategy. Bigger came on, made a big impact, and so then you could say, well, Warren, you know, got that absolutely spot on in his selection. I think back row they probably do need they need to tweak around that, and the ball carrier stuff, you know. And we look at, you know, another pet hate of mine, but the amount of tackle rates that have gone through the roof in the last 20 years and rucks has meant that, you know, you need a lot of big ball carriers, you know, and Wales are probably shy of a couple of those, and Faletau will half solve that. But in a World Cup campaign where you will get key injuries, you're going to need a bit more depth, a bit more carrying, if Wales are going to continue to play the game they kind of played at the weekend.
This is not a technical matter from the weekend, but the amount of tackles you have to make now. To me, it is absolutely remarkable that people will still go along and watch rugby and be entertained by it when the heart, four-fifths of the game, is some mindless pick-up, go around the corner, pick-up and go around the corner. And the idea that that should be rated as a tackle when a guy is just going to run straight into you and head first anyway, so all you've got to do is push him down. The idea that that should be a tackle is just ridiculous. And the next thing they've got to do after the World Cup is they've got to reduce the number of the number of mini rucks, and the boring round the corner stuff is completely taking over the game.
Yeah.
And rugby must be a great game because people still love it even with all that.
It's amazing, isn't it? I didn't think the weekend's game was a decent game at all. It had a huge amount of atmosphere, and there was, you know, that we were. That was great, and the occasion, but the actual game, you know, we're just box kicking,
I'm so glad you said that. I think that was maybe one of the things that actually being there made us reporters slightly oversell it, because it just felt amazing to be in there. But I watched it a second time, and likewise, it was a sort of reminder, hang on a sec, you know, Wales spilt so much ball in the first half. England had a lot of ball in the first half and weren't able to do a lot with it.
It's a poor game. But that is becoming, unfortunately, the norm rather than the exception.
But
all you got to do is have a look at how have we allowed this game to go from, what, 150 tackles a game to about 400 to 600, you know, in 2 decades. And we've got ruck counts that have gone through the roof to hundreds in games, potentially. And we haven't adapted. And the game is you know, driving ourselves towards a point where something terrible will happen. And I can't quite understand how we're still getting all the support and all the following for a game that actually the spectacle is becoming worse and worse. Something will change. Something will have to change.
But what you're saying is sometimes it's a disaster that makes you change it.
Yeah.
It could be something horrible happen.
Well, there's been enough of them in France, which is why the French are proposing dramatic changes to the game.
And we're constantly, as a sport, we are only ever really made any changes. I was talking about this morning with Mark Evans. We talk about, I don't know when the game was where there were 160 odd lineouts in England Wales game at 19 something, and they changed
66.
Changed the laws around, you know, where you can kick the ball and where lineouts are. And that was all a reaction. It's always been reactions. Whereas other sports are a little bit more proactive around all of that to try to see what it will look like if we continue to allow this to happen. You are only going to get heavier players, more emphasis on power, the contacts are going to be more, it's going to be more attritional, The game's going to be devalued. Injuries are going to rise. Everything's going to get worse.
Jonesy, if you limit it to a certain number of pick and goes, would that make you happy, or would that just be call it five pick and goes, and then you've got to turn the ball over, and you get another sport called rugby league?
Well, it then becomes even more like rugby league than it is at the moment. It's quite like rugby league. 1993, a guy called Roger Vanderfield, an Australian, threw out, with his committee, if you're going forward, you keep the ball, and it went to use it or lose it. And then the forwards were no longer needed in the rucks and balls, so they all departed and formed two lines. And as David Campese said, the year after that, he said, I was never been tackled by so many props, because he was, the field was suddenly in rugby league formation. Then the game's never recovered from it, especially since, as Ben says, he took it 400 rucks. But actually, a ruck is something that should be contestable, but it's only contestable when a jackal comes in for the first couple of seconds. If he's told to get out of the way, then it's not contestable, because they won't allow you to ruck. So it's almost like 400 times you lie down on the floor, but after you've had this crunch, after you've had the crunch where you might get a head knock, then you just fall to the floor and then they do it again.
Yeah, it's just mind-bogglingly stupid.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're now joined by Sarah Hunter, the England women's captain, after another successful weekend for the England women. They're 3 from 3, beat Wales at the weekend 51-12. Sarah, you didn't play in the game, but you must have been pretty delighted with the way your team went.
Yeah, no, it was great. Obviously, shows the strength and depth that we have in our squad at the minute, that we can make 7 changes and 2 positional changes off the back of the France game, and put in another sort of prominent performance against Wales in Cardiff, which is always a difficult place to come and play.
Mm. And your three point analysis of the weekend again, which we like so much. Do you want to kick off with that?
Yeah, so first was the game on Saturday between Italy and Ireland. We spoke about Italy and their rise to sort of form, and over the seasons have got better and better. And the talking point for this is that they currently sit second in the table. And I don't think anyone would have thought that before the tournament kicked off. They beat Ireland, a very strong side, 29-27 at home. You know, they put their 3-3 draw against Wales last time out sort of behind them, and really showed the force that they've become, which is particularly interesting as we take them on in our next Six Nations game. You know, some of their players that are really coming to the fore, and their number 7 Franco and Furlan, that from fullback, really are their talisman players that sort of ignite the Italian side, and no doubt they'll be very buoyant coming to England in a couple of weeks' time.
So that's a really exciting challenge for you then?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's what we obviously need. So it was the first time they beat Ireland as well, so they've never beaten Ireland in the history of their their women's game, which is fantastic for them. And, you know, they're always sort of a very difficult team to play against us, for us to play against, sorry. And I think them coming to England in 2 weeks' time and us knowing we want to improve on our performance. Yes, it wasn't the finished article yesterday when we played, and we know we need to get better. And Italy always seem a challenge for us. You know, they stifle us by the way they come at us as a breakdown, and they put pressure on us and the way they defend. So we know we'll have to be really at the top of our game if we don't want an upset there.
Mm-hmm. Hey Sarah, it's Ben Ryan here. I've got
Hi Ben.
My question really is around the timings and selection of Six Nations teams for the women, because I look at the Sevens World Series for women and see that Ireland and France have prioritised this year putting their players in the Sevens programme to try to get automatic qualification for the Olympics, whereas England have done the opposite and they're sitting in eighth place in the World Series but are sitting in top place in the Six Nations. Do you think, well, two things, would you, as a player, would you like to somehow organise the Six Nations so that you've got the chance to play full strength Ireland and France sides, and does that mean that you need to have it at another time of the season? And secondly, when you look at the women and the teams in Europe, you could argue that Italy, Wales and Scotland could be replaced by Spain and Russia, potentially as two options that are stronger as women's nations rugby teams than perhaps Scotland and Wales. Where, do you think you need to stick with the same teams that the men have?
I think as we develop, I think you want probably the best teams in the competition. And would, knowing that there was a promotion relegation battle in Six Nations, make other nations that sort of are at that end of the table like improve on their performance, or would it allow more investment into their women's game from those unions, so actually they became stronger and they became more competitive? It's a really interesting conversation. I think as we go forward, as a player, you want to be playing the best teams. But then this argument of, does our Six Nations being aligned to the men, does that give us more exposure and awareness of the game at the minute? So I think it's a really interesting conversation to be have, but I don't think we should be necessarily afraid to have that conversation in terms of what works best for the women's game, not just what has been because of what the men's program was doing as well. And you could have the same conversation in the men's program, you know, obviously with the likes of the Georgians like being really competitive in the men's side of the game, and probably could they, and other nations as well, could they push for that sort of bottom space in the men's Six Nations? So I think just because traditionally what we've always done doesn't mean to say we have to continue to do that.
Well said, Sarah.
You wanted to talk about the new age props?
We've sort of started to see them come to the fore, but I think it's replicated in the men's game. You see like the likes of Tad Furlong, Kyle Sinclair, and what was the traditional prop of, oh, we're just going to scrum and we'll just do our set piece, and you probably won't see them around the park. You know, we saw a performance from Sarah Byrne yesterday, who, yes, does her job at set piece, but she's running out in the back line like a centre and sidestepping like a fullback and, you know, running in tries. And you see that when they made substitutions, when sort of Shauna Brown comes on and makes line breaks. Hannah Botman's done it not just in this game, they've done it continuously through the Autumn Internationals, the Six Nations, and I think we're really seeing a different breed of props or players, forwards, that coming through. You know, it's not, when you get away from set piece time, like, it's not the number on your back that matters, it's about how you can contribute in your skill set to the game. But I think it was really applicable yesterday and really evident, especially with our front row. You could look at our hookers as well, in terms of Amy Cocaine and the way she plays like as an extra back row player around the pitch. But I think it's really exciting to see that they're actually changing changing the way and the stigma around a front row forward and what it takes to be a modern day prop in this game.
Sarah Byrne was absolutely amazing yesterday, Sarah. Yeah. Actually, I know she's like most props, now she's really hefty, but she looked to have the skills of a sevens player as well. She was very, very rapid indeed, and I, in a way, felt sorry for those poor Welsh girls trying to tackle her.
Yeah,
she
was amazing. I'm glad she's on our team, that's for sure. But but yeah, her, and it's a testament to the work of all the players, what they go away and do, and they do in their own time and their skills time, and what the coaches are having us do, as you know, like improving our ball handling skills, like decision making, the time that we have in terms of our strength and conditioning program, on the speed and the agility work that we do and that she does, especially in the forwards especially do, you know. So and she started life as a back row, so she's probably getting those sort of days back out there again. But yeah, she's fantastic to have, and we obviously missed her during the autumn with injury, but it's fantastic to see her come back into the form she was before she got injured. So yeah, she certainly set the game on fire yesterday.
Sarah, that's brilliant. Thanks very much. You back to Bisham for the week now?
No, we've got a few days back at our clubs training there, and then we'll come in for a couple of days at the end of the week to start looking at our preparation towards Italy in a couple of weeks' time.
Okay, well, listen, go well, and I think we're speaking to you again in a couple of weeks' time after the Italy game.
Yeah, it'd be great to speak to you then.
Good luck, Sarah.
Great to talk. I was wondering about the women's competition. Maybe they should just have it at a different time to the men. I mean, the men's competition, there's so much attention and media on it, that maybe if the women just did it at a different part of the year, then they would get more focus themselves,
yeah,
you
exactly.
think?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, Stephen.
Well, I was going to say, that would have two. First of all, they have more focus, and B, as Ben suggested, they might be able to sort of align the programmes a little bit better, so you're not going into one or the other, either sevens or 15. So, I don't know, I think that the more they break away, I mean, I don't even think every single law that's passed for the men's game need necessarily be helpful for the women. They should split away a little bit. They should split away a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's we're seeing there's two things around planning for the women. One is, you know, that now, as a result of probably England prioritising the 15s women's team in the Six Nations, their sevens team that represents the qualification for Great Britain for the Tokyo 2020 Olympics are struggling. And they're eighth, and there's three European teams above them. So if they don't get in the automatic slots, which is top four, which they won't, they've got to go through Europe, and they won't at the moment get anywhere near those European teams.
So the chances of a GB women's team at the Olympics is quite slim now.
It's slim. I would say it's very slim now, because they're going to have to go through the repechage, Europe, or the repechage, and both of those at the moment on form, they're way below where
they should
be. That's
the team that in Rio thought they could win the thing.
And whether they now then have to, you know, for those that playoff in Europe, they chuck in all their main players against teams that have been together all year, and then in the Six Nations it's a shame, you know, they had a big match against France that in Doncaster that was labelled as the, you know, the decider, but French girls, you know, their top players were playing the weekend before in sevens tournament and weren't playing. And England want to play against the best, so that when they eventually get to a World Cup for 15s and they play the All Blacks, who are the only competition they really have at full strength, or a French full strength side, they're used to that intensity. So I see that as a, you know, you want the best against the best in the women's game, and then it's, you know, to another level when you look at the bottom of the Premiership and you see Newcastle losing without key players, and then, you know, and Worcester beating Leicester with all their raft of players, and that the Premiership are now getting hampered by producing English qualified players because they're missing players in very key games.
Yes,
huge games. Massively. You look at Newcastle now, are in danger of getting relegated, and what they've got, Graham and Wilson missing this weekend, that are going to be in camp in a big game for them. And so, well, that's not fair. I mean, what's going on there?
Well, it's just touching on that, I wanted to talk about that briefly. But I mean, so as you say, this Sunday is arguably the Premiership relegation decider. Newcastle, Worcester. Newcastle on 17 and Worcester on 26, albeit Bristol are on 26 as well. But if Newcastle lose that, then they're sort of feeling cut adrift, aren't they?
Yeah, and it's a great shame, because everybody loved their progress last year. They're an outpost, and did fantastically well to reach in the top four. They got the big game at St James's Park, which was great. This time at the end of the season, there's going to be big rugby days at Newcastle for the two finals of Europe. And I know that the Newcastle Falcons have organised a massive thing around it, you know, a festival of games and all that. It's an absolute crying shame that they should be at the bottom there.
Mm-hmm. But as you say, Ben, it's kind of an example of rugby doesn't work. You know, it's a game that we still don't know how to manage or to administer properly. That the fact that there is this overlap and the clubs are doing their utmost to stop this overlap so that they don't play at the same time as international weekends.
So what's the answer? So they go to
11-month season and everyone thinks that's terrible, which it is.
Yeah.
Doesn't work.
And we're again, like, you know, I was speaking to Mark Evans this morning about this and, you know, we just didn't even, no one's even done any, like, looking into whether what would happen if we did cut the games down and we had less. How would that affect the finances and the preparation, the play and everything? But we haven't gone to that point. But to have your domestic competition that you're trying to say is the most competitive league in the world, and then they're playing at the same time that their best players are playing on international duty, football wouldn't even dream of that occurring. They just shut down the Premiership when there's an international window. So we need to. I mean, that's just so unfair on the clubs. And like you say, the ones at the bottom, and then what happens? What's the ripple? Bristol, they recruit overseas players that are past test matches or not going to be used, and they don't have any problems around that. But then they're not, you know, as a result of that, they're not bringing enough English players through the system.
Or look at Wasps, for instance, who in the last year have lost Haskell and Cipriani. They're going to lose Elliot Daly. They're going to lose Nathan Hughes, and they've lost Christian Wade.
Yeah.
Those five English players, and I off the top of my head, I don't know, but the amount of foreign players that have come in their stead,
yeah,
because they will be able to play them at those weekends. You know, they replaced English with foreign.
It's I mean, like, you speak to all the DORs and head coaches, and it's a big, you know, point for them when they're recruiting. Get players that are not going to be called up by Six Nations or in the November internationals, yeah, so that they can get use of them in the Premiership. That's just wrong on lots of levels.
Right, back to Six Nations, because we haven't talked about a number of the other nations. France made something of a comeback. They've invented their team for the first weekend, reinvented for the second, and then reinvented again for the third. And now they've, I don't know, who knows if they found something. Not convincing, but they did play against a Scotland who have been so ravaged by injury that it's really hard to assess them. Steve, what do you make any sense of that, or do you just think that was a bit of a contest that's hard to judge because of the situation that the Scots were in?
A little bit. You do feel sorry for them, but let's be fair. I think either three or four TMO decisions ruled out French tries, which I don't mean they were tries, but I mean they came very close.
Yeah.
If the TMO is there, you've come very close to scoring. And I think France really dominated, and there was a time at the end where I think the Scottish try really unbalanced the score, and I thought they were palpably the better side, much better than they were against England, which is not difficult. The back three looked like they'd ever met before for a start. Even Bastereau stirred himself. I still think they're wrong. I think Camilo Lopez is still the best 10. He may be an unlikely figure. But one or two of the fours are beginning to fire. I think Demba Bamba's made the 20-year-olds made a difference. Yeah. And Vahamina stirred himself. Louis Picamole, don't know what he was thinking at Twickenham. He didn't play any part in it. I think maybe the shame of Twickenham has helped them. And they were a lot better. You do feel very sorry for Scotland. Is it 14 players out or something? But
more.
For France,
quite a lot more than that.
Yeah, OK. Well, thank God France were improved, definitely.
Ben, you work as a part-time consultant to the French Rugby Federation.
Yeah.
So I'd just be interested in your perspective on this. So that you'd have read the media from the first 2 weeks, particularly of the Six Nations, in the English written media, that this is and at home, all over, French have got a complete hammering for those two performances and everything that went into those defeats. From your perspective, are France really as low as they did seem then? Can you see them coming back? How do you see them at the moment?
Two really quick things. One is, I can definitely see progression as far as systems that are being put into place to give France a much better chance and consistently at test match level. But then secondly, they got selection badly wrong in the first couple of games, and they started to address that in the game against Scotland, particularly I think in the mix of the back line and their decision making, and as a result of that they flowed a little bit better. There's a few things happening in France. So one is the amount of French qualified players is going up every year, and Bernard Laporte brought that in when he was one of his big flags he flew when he got presidency, and that's gonna take time. It's gonna mean more and more players are gonna go into the top 14 and Pro de Deux that are French qualified, and that's gonna have a knock on effect for providing better players that are more experienced in test match, and then the academies and everything else, and in particular positions like back three wingers. It's all Fijian in the top 14, so that over the next couple of years, you're only going to get one or two that are going to be playing, and the rest will be French qualified. So that's good. Age grade are better. They still need to address the conditioning, because you've only got to watch the tempo of a top 14 game versus a Premiership game, and everything's so much quicker. You've only got to watch England versus France, and I had a French friend that was saying that he would do his analysis and the line out would be go to touch in the top 14, and then he'd be able to do the analysis in between the time it took to kick the ball to touch and the line out. He said he couldn't do that in the England-France game. First three line outs England took, by the time he looked up at the TV, the ball was back in play.
Yeah.
Just don't have that tempo of what's happening in top 14. So there's definitely some improvements that are happening, and they have an end goal: 2023 World Cup in France, 2024 Olympics in Paris for their men's and women's sevens teams. They have good age grade.
Can you give a one word answer to the fear of Englishmen that they'll get to Japan and that, you know, that French that mythical French team that never turns up will actually turn up?
They won't get to Japan and be able, they do well historically in World Cups. The top 14 final is later than it has been, gives them less time on the ground than they've had in previous World Cups. That's going to affect play. They're going to need to have a little bit of luck to hit a semi-final, I think. You've got to look in 5 years' time for the home World Cup, where I would say they will be you'll be talking about them in 4 years as favourites for that. They have the players. If they can get everything else right and put the right staff in, affect conditioning, the league system is going to improve. With that will come a better intensity, and things are slowly on the up there.
Okay, gents, thanks very much. We are going to wrap up with our final regular item, our God or Goddess of the Week, someone who's caught your eye, done something amazing. Jonesy?
Mine is Goddess, because I'm tired of talking about Wales and England. I was tired of it before the game started, frankly. I did enjoy the game, and I enjoyed working on it, but I've now moved on, Slotty.
Well done. I'm still there, by the way.
I've moved on. Sarah Byrne for England on Sunday against Wales, against an outgunned, outpowered Wales team in Italy, was absolutely devastatingly good. Sarah said, handling, sidestepping, my goodness, that just must have been inspirational for a lot of the bigger girls in rugby. To, you know, there is a role for you, get fit, you can be skillful, big, fast, fit, do your stuff in the scrum, love the game in the loose. So she was my goddess because she played brilliantly, but was an example to everyone out there.
Very good. Very strong.
Thank you, Scott.
Ben?
Mine was a pair of gods, really, and I don't normally disagree with Stephen, but I think in Antomac there's a fly half there that is massively inexperienced and raw, but he has incredible amount of talent, and if they stick with him and Toulouse play him at 10, Dupont on Antomac could be around the French setup for a long, long time, and I thought they both played very well at the weekend, and for me they're the gods of the week.
Very good. Mine, I will go back to the Wales-England game because I think, well, that was the resonating match of the entire weekend. And I will go with the Wales coach, who people like to say might one day be the England coach. That's a conversation for another day. Warren Gatland, who put together a team that did what many people didn't think they were going to. He out-coached Eddie Jones and... just put together a superlative team. Have we ever worked out how we decide this?
Yeah, you do, because you're in charge.
So I'm in charge, so I could really bat my own man. All right, well, because we like having Ben on so much, we want him to come back again, I'm going to go for the French halfbacks. Thank you very much, Ben, for being on. Great to see you. Jonesy, I'll be seeing you later.
Yes, you will. And have you got your acceptance speech ready?
No, I'm waiting to hear yours.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think we need to explain that next week. You were listening to The Ruck. Thank you very much indeed. We'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.